Chapter 8. Synchronicity. C.G. Jung's A-Causal Connecting Principle. Many of us have experienced situations in which the seemingly predictable fabric of everyday reality, woven from complex chains of causes and effects, seems to tear apart, and we experience stunning and highly implausible coincidences. During episodes of holotropic states of consciousness, though, striking coincidences that seem meaningful tend to happen with great frequency. The accumulation of extraordinary coincidences can bring the elements of magic, numinosity, and cosmic artistry into everyday reality, and play an important role in the process of spiritual opening. However, experiencing chains of coincidences can also create serious problems in life and become a dangerous pitfall. Sometimes, these coincidences can be very ingratiating, promising, and empowering, and convince the individual that he or she is special and has been chosen for an important role in the world. A saint, prophet, savior, leader, or spiritual teacher. This situation, dangerous ego inflation, can cause irrational behavior and lead to psychiatric hospitalization. Other times, the content of these coincidences is ominous, and they seem to portend danger or disaster. The individual has the sense of a rapidly closing circle of threatening circumstances and becomes terrified and paranoid. Mainstream psychiatry does not recognize the concept of personally meaningful coincidences and labels any patients who talk about them as suffering from delusions of reference. According to materialistic science, there is no inherent meaning in the universe, and in a world that is random and disenchanted, any semblance of a deeper personal meaning of events has to be an illusion introduced into it by human projection. However, anyone who is open-minded and is willing to listen and learn about these occurrences has to admit that the probability of these just being happenstances is astronomically low. Such violations of linear causality can occur so frequently that they raise serious questions about the nature of reality and the worldview in which we have all grown up. This can be very disturbing for people who draw a great sense of comfort and safety from the belief that they live in a lawful and predictable world. Any experiences that challenge it can trigger a fear of insanity. Understanding the phenomenon of meaningful coincidences is therefore essential for safe navigation through non-ordinary realities, and is a sine qua non for psychonauts experimenting with psychedelic substances or experiencing spiritual emergency. Indiscriminate sharing of such experiences with the wrong people and acting under their influence can become the reason for psychiatric diagnosis and hospitalization. The Swiss psychiatrist C.G. Jung was the scientist who brought the problem of meaningful coincidences defying rational explanation to the attention of academic circles. Aware of the fact that the staunch and unswerving belief in rigid determinism represents the cornerstone of the Western scientific worldview, he hesitated for more than 20 years before he felt that he had collected enough supportive evidence to make his discovery public. Expecting strong disbelief and harsh criticism from his colleagues, he wanted to be sure that he could back his heretic claims with hundreds of examples. He finally described his groundbreaking observations in his famous essay, Synchronicity, an A-Causal Connecting Principle, and presented it at the Arinos meeting of 1951. Arinos meetings were conferences of stellar European and American thinkers in which Jung was the principal initiator and participant. It included the intellectual elite of the world, including people like Joseph Campbell, Heinrich Zimmer, Karl Kerenyi, Erich Neumann, Olga Frobe-Kapteyn, Erwin Schrödinger, Wolfgang Pauli, Daisetsu Taitaro Suzuki, Paul Tillich, Marie-Louise von Franz, Rudolf Otto, Richard Wilhelm, Mircea Eliade, and Gershom Scholem. Jung began his essay with examples of extraordinary coincidences occurring in everyday life. He acknowledged the Austrian Lamarckian biologist Paul Kammerer, whose tragic life was popularized in Arthur Koestler's book The Case of the Midwife Toad, as one of the first people to be interested in this phenomenon and its scientific implications. Kammerer studied and described a type of striking coincidence which he called seriality. One of the remarkable examples Kammerer had reported was a sequence of three encounters with the same number on the same day. His streetcar ticket bore the same number as the theater ticket he bought immediately afterward. Then, later that evening, he asked for a telephone number and was given the same sequence of digits. Kammerer was fascinated by this phenomenon. He spent many hours in parks and other public places watching how many people passed by, how many had umbrellas, hats, dogs, and so on. In his book, Law of the Series, he described 100 anecdotes of remarkable coincidences. His biographer, Arthur Koestler, reported that when he was writing Kammerer's biography, The Case of the Midwife Toad, he experienced a meteor shower of coincidences, as if Kammerer's ghost was grinning down at him and saying, "I told you so." Jung was also interested in seriality and described his own examples of it. One morning, he saw an inscription with a figure which was half man and half fish. The same day, he was served fish for lunch, and someone made an April fish of another person, Swiss equivalent of the American making an April Fool of someone. In the afternoon, a former patient showed him an impressive picture of a fish. That evening, Jung saw an embroidery with sea monsters and fishes on it. The next morning, a patient reported a dream of a large fish. A few months later, when Jung was writing about this extraordinary series of events, he went for a walk and saw a foot-long fish lying on the wall by the lake. He pointed out that earlier that day, he had walked by that spot several times and did not see the fish, and nobody was around. Jung was aware that this phenomenon could be accounted for by using statistics, but emphasized that the large number of the repetitions made it highly unlikely. In the same essay on synchronicity, Jung also related the amusing story told by famous astronomer Camille Flammarion about the French writer Émile Duchamp and a special kind of plum pudding. As a boy, Duchamp was given a piece of this rare pudding by a Monsieur de Fongibou. For the 10 years that followed, he had no opportunity to taste this delicacy until he saw the same pudding on the menu at a Parisian restaurant. He called the waiter and ordered it, but the waiter came back with the message that they had already served the last portion of it to another guest. He pointed across the room, and there sat Monsieur de Fongibou, enjoying the last bites of the dessert. Many years later, Monsieur Duchamp was invited to a party where this pudding was served as a special treat. While he was eating it, he remarked that the only thing lacking was Monsieur de Fongibou, who had introduced him to this delicacy and had also been present during his second encounter with it in the Paris restaurant. At that moment, the doorbell rang, and an old man walked in looking very confused. It was Monsieur de Fontgibou, who had burst in on the party by mistake because he had been given the wrong address. The existence of such extraordinary coincidences is difficult to reconcile with the understanding of the universe that has been developed by materialistic science, which describes the world in terms of chains of causes and effects. And the probability that something like this would happen by chance is so infinitesimal that it cannot be seriously considered as an explanation. It is certainly easier to imagine that these occurrences have some deeper meaning, and that they may be playful creations of cosmic intelligence. This explanation is particularly plausible when they contain an element of humor, which is often the case. Although coincidences of this kind are extremely interesting in and of themselves, the work of C.G. Jung added another fascinating dimension to these challenging, anomalous phenomena. The situations described by Kammerer and by Flammarion involved highly implausible coincidences, and the story about the plum pudding certainly has an element of humor. However, both stories described happenings in the world of matter. Jung's observations added another astonishing element to this already baffling phenomenon. He described numerous instances of what he called synchronicity, remarkable coincidences in which various events in reality were meaningfully linked to intrapsychic experiences such as dreams or visions. He defined synchronicity as a simultaneous occurrence of a certain psychic state with one or more external events which appear as meaningful parallels to the momentary subjective state. Situations of this kind show that our psyche can enter into playful interaction with what appears to be the world of matter. The fact that something like this is possible effectively blurs the boundaries between subjective and objective reality. Struggling with this phenomenon, Jung became very interested in the developments in quantum relativistic physics and in the radically new worldview to which they were pointing. He had many intellectual exchanges with Wolfgang Pauli, one of the founders of quantum physics, who was initially his client and later his personal friend. Pauli came to Jung with bizarre dreams, which featured combinations of numbers and archetypal figures reaching back into the Middle Ages, such as the Wild Man, Veiled Woman, Ouroboros, World Clock, Quadrature of the Circle, and Perpetuum Mobile. Later, when they became friends, they explored various problems involving the interface between mathematics, physics, and psychology. Arthur Miller wrote a remarkable book about the extraordinary relationship between Jung and Pauli, especially their fascination with the number 137. Under Pauli's guidance, Jung became familiar with the revolutionary concepts in modern physics, including the challenges to deterministic thinking and linear causality that had been introduced into science. Synchronicity is of great theoretical significance in quantum relativistic physics due to important experiments that seem to indicate that the universe might be radically non-local. This deserves a brief detour into the history of this discipline. Throughout his life, Albert Einstein, whose work had initiated the development of quantum physics, showed great resistance to the idea of the fundamental role of probability in nature. He expressed it in his famous statement, "God does not play dice." In order to show that Niels Bohr's interpretation of quantum theory was wrong, Einstein devised a thought experiment, which later became known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen EPR experiment. Ironically, several decades later, this experiment served as the basis for John Bell's theorem that proves that the Cartesian concept of reality is incompatible with quantum theory. The simplified version of the EPR experiment involves two electrons spinning in opposite directions so that their total spin is zero. They are made to move apart until the distance between them becomes macroscopic. Their respective spins can then be measured by two independent observers. Quantum theory predicts that in a system of two particles with a total spin of zero, the spins along any axis will always be correlated, which is to say, opposite. Before the actual measurement, one can only talk about tendencies to spin. Once the measurement is made, though, this potential is transformed into certainty. The observer is free to choose any axis of measurement, which instantly determines the spin of the other particle that might be thousands of miles away. According to the theory of relativity, no signal can travel faster than light, and therefore this situation should, in principle, be impossible. The instantaneous, non-local connection between these particles cannot thus be mediated by signals in the Einsteinian sense. Communication of this kind transcends the conventional concept of information transfer. Initially, Einstein's thought experiment was designed to disprove quantum theory, but a number of experiments have since confirmed that the particles remain entangled. Bell's theorem leaves the physicists with an uncomfortable dilemma. It suggests that either the world is radically non-local, connected by supraluminal links, or not objectively real. Jung published his essay on synchronicity in the 1951 Aranos volume. Wolfgang Pauli's article on a related subject was in the same issue. Jung's essay on synchronicity and Pauli's study of the influence of the archetype of the sun on the work of Johannes Kepler has often been published in one volume. It is interesting that Pauli's life involved an ongoing incidence of synchronicities. Physical instruments, for example, broke down with great frequency whenever he was in the building. Astronomer George Gamow called it the Pauli effect. It was humorously called the second Pauli exclusion principle, according to which a functioning device and Wolfgang Pauli may not occupy the same room. Pauli himself was convinced that the effect named after him was real. He corresponded about it with German parapsychologist Hans Bender and saw this effect as an example of synchronicity. Jung was aware that his own observations appeared much more plausible and acceptable in the context of the emerging new understanding of reality. Additional support for Jung's ideas came from no less than Albert Einstein, who, during a personal visit, encouraged Jung to pursue his idea of synchronicity, because it was fully compatible with the new discoveries in physics. Since the publication of Jung's essay on synchronicity, this concept has become increasingly important in science and has been the subject of many articles and books. On the other side of the spectrum, the existence of synchronicity aids in the understanding of esoteric systems of divination, such as tarot, work with cowrie shells, and the I Ching. As Marie-Louise von Franz pointed out in her book On Divination and Synchronicity, The Psychology of Meaningful Chance, synchronistic thinking was the classic way of thinking in ancient China, and was developed and differentiated there much more than in any other civilization. This involved thinking in terms of fields, rather than in terms of linear causality. The question is not why something has come about, or what caused a specific effect, but what happens together in a meaningful way in the same moment. The Chinese philosopher always asks, what tends to happen together in time? So the center of their field concept would be the moment of time in which certain events assemble in clusters. In the Chinese way of thinking, one does not ask whether material processes cause psychological events, or if the psychological processes caused events in the material world. Only in later thinking did we find a differentiation between the material and psychological aspects of existence. Therefore, when we inquire what tends to occur together, we can bring in both inner and outer facts. For the synchronistic way of thinking, it is essential to watch both areas of reality, the physical and the psychic, and to notice that at the moment when one had certain thoughts or certain dreams, there were certain physical and psychological events. It is a certain moment in time which is the uniting fact, the focal point for the observation of this complex of events. The concept of synchronicity could only have originated in a civilization that has a materialistic worldview and sees the world as an assembly of separate objects interacting in a way that is governed by the principle of linear causality. The universe is portrayed as an infinitely complex system of chains of causes and effects. In the primal worldview, where everything is interconnected in a participation mystique, synchronicity is seen as a universal principle. The entire world is so pervaded by meaning and replete with signs and symbols that synchronicity is not a separate concept. To describe the universe, ancient humanity used words like sympathy, harmony, and unity. In the 4th century BC, the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Heraclitus of Ephesus viewed all things as being interrelated. Similarly, the legendary Greek physician Hippocrates said, "There is one common flow, one common breathing. All things are in sympathy." And Roman philosopher Plotinus, the founder of Neoplatonism and author of the Aeneids, wrote, "The stars are like letters that inscribe themselves at every moment in the sky. Everything in the world is full of signs. All events are coordinated. All things depend on each other. Everything breathes together." These are examples of the classic idea that separateness is an illusion. The native, ancient, classical, and medieval worldviews also postulated the existence of a principal alternative to linear causality, in the form of a higher force. Even for Wilhelm Gottfried Leibniz, 19th century German philosopher, causality was neither the only view nor the principal one. One example of an alternative to linear causality are the processes of movie making and movie watching, in which the causality that we observe only seems to be true. It is, in fact, only a method to communicate a story. The people who created the movies arranged the sequences of scenes and images in such a way that we perceive them as causally connected. The Hindus, who understand the universe as Lila, a divine play created by cosmic consciousness who is orchestrating experiences, apply the same type of thinking to the world of matter. All the magical and mantic procedures of earlier ages were based on a similar understanding of the world. With the rise of physical sciences, the correspondence theory vanished completely, and the magical world of earlier ages disappeared. It was replaced by thinking in terms of linear causality, which became the cornerstone of materialistic science. Synchronistic thinking is also essential for an adequate understanding of archetypal astrology. Jung used astrology in his essay to demonstrate the multiple synchronistic interconnections involving the material world and the human psyche. In the later years of his life, he routinely looked at the astrological charts of his patients before he began working with them. His daughter, Grete Baumann Jung, specifically studied astrology to cast the horoscopes of Jung's patients for him, and to present a paper on her father's chart for the Psychological Club in Zurich in 1974. Toward the end of his life, Jung became so convinced of the importance of synchronicity in the natural order of things that he used it as a guiding principle in his everyday life. The most famous case of synchronicity in Jung's life occurred during a therapy session with one of his clients. This patient was very resistant to psychotherapy, to Jung's interpretations, and to the notion of transpersonal realities. During the analysis of one of her dreams, featuring a golden scarab, when the therapy had reached a major impasse, Jung heard something hit the window pane. He went to check what had happened and found a shiny rose chafer beetle, Cetonia aurata, on the windowsill, trying to get inside. It was a very rare specimen, the nearest analogy to a golden scarab that can be found in that latitude. Nothing like that had ever happened to Jung before or afterwards. He opened the window, brought the beetle inside, and showed it to his client. This extraordinary synchronicity became an important turning point in this woman's therapy. The observations of synchronicities had a profound impact on Jung's thinking and his work, particularly on his understanding of archetypes, primordial governing and organizing principles of the collective unconscious. The discovery of archetypes and their role in the human psyche represent Jung's most important contribution to psychology. For much of his professional career, Jung was very strongly influenced by the Cartesian-Kantian perspective dominating Western science, with its strict division between subjective and objective, inner and outer. Under its influence, he initially saw the archetypes as trans-individual, but essentially intra-psychic principles, comparable to biological instincts. He presumed that the basic matrix for them was hardwired into the brain and was inherited from generation to generation. The existence of synchronistic events made Jung realize that archetypes transcend both the psyche and the material world. He believed that they are autonomous patterns of meaning that inform both the psyche and matter. He saw that they provide a bridge between inner and outer and suggested the existence of a twilight zone between matter and consciousness. For this reason, Jung started referring to archetypes as having a psychoid, psyche-like quality. Using the term coined by Hans Driesch, the founder of vitalism, Stefan Holler described Jung's advanced understanding of the archetypes in a succinct way, using poetic language. The archetype, then, when manifesting in a synchronistic phenomenon, is truly awesome, if not outright miraculous, an uncanny dweller on the threshold. at once psychical and physical. It might be likened to the two-faced Roman god Janus. The two faces of the archetype are joined in the common head of meaning. Psychiatrists often hear from their patients about fantastic coincidences. However, the remarkable phenomenon of synchronicity has not been recognized by mainstream psychology and psychiatry. References to unbelievable coincidences are dismissed and seen as pathological distortions of perception and judgment, or delusions of reference. However, anyone who takes the time to check the facts has to admit that the probability of many of these coincidences being accidental is infinitesimally low. During the 60 years I have been involved in consciousness research, I have observed many extraordinary synchronicities in my patients, particularly in those undergoing psychedelic therapy and experiencing spiritual emergencies, as well as in participants in holotropic breathwork workshops and training. I have also heard many stories about them from my fellow researchers and therapists, and personally experienced hundreds of them myself. I would like to illustrate this discussion of synchronicity with several examples. Interested readers can find more examples of remarkable synchronicities in my book, When the Impossible Happens. The first of these examples is an extraordinary story involving my late friend and teacher, the famous mythologist Joseph Campbell. It bears some similarity to Jung's encounter with the golden beetle in that it involves the appearance of an insect in a highly unlikely time and place. During one of his many workshops at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, Joe gave a long talk on his favorite subject, the work of C.G. Jung and his revolutionary contributions to the understanding of mythology and psychology. During this lecture, he made a fleeting reference to the phenomenon of synchronicity. One of the participants, who was not familiar with this term, interrupted Joe and asked him to explain it. After giving Jung's brief general definition and description of this concept, Joe decided to share with the audience an example of a remarkable synchronicity from his own life. Before moving to Hawaii later in life, Joe and his wife, Jean Erdman, had lived in New York City's Greenwich Village. Their apartment was on the 14th floor of a high-rise building on Waverly Place and 6th Avenue. Joe's study had two pairs of windows, one facing the Hudson River and the other up 6th Avenue. The first set of windows offered a beautiful view of the river, and during nice weather they were always open. The view from the other two windows was uninteresting, and the Campbells very seldom opened them. According to Joe, they might not have opened them more than two or three times during their 40-odd years living there, except for cleaning. One day in the early 1980s, Joe was in his study working on his magnum opus, The Way of the Animal Powers, a comprehensive encyclopedia of shamanic mythologies of the world. At that time, he was writing the chapter on mythology of the African Kung Bushmen, a tribe living in the Kalahari Desert. One of the most important deities in the Bushmen pantheon is Mantis, who combines the characteristics of a trickster figure and the creator god. Joe was deeply immersed in this work, surrounded by articles, books, and pictures on the subject. He was particularly impressed by the story Lawrence Vanderpost wrote about his half-Bushman nanny, Clara, who had taken care of him since the moment of his birth. Vanderpost vividly remembered instances from his childhood when Clara was able to communicate with a praying mantis, Mantis religiosa. When she talked to the member of this species, Asking specific questions, the insect seemed to respond by moving its legs and body. In the middle of this work, Joe suddenly felt an irresistible and completely irrational impulse to get up and open one of the windows facing 6th Avenue, windows with a boring view that normally remained closed all the time. After he opened it, he immediately looked to the right without understanding why he was doing it. The last thing one would expect to encounter in Manhattan is a praying mantis. And yet, there it was, a large specimen of its kind, on the 14th floor of a high-rise building in Lower Manhattan, climbing slowly upward. According to Joe, it turned its head and gave him a meaningful look. Although this encounter lasted only a few seconds, it had an uncanny quality and left a powerful impression on Joe. He said he could confirm what he had read just minutes earlier in Lauren's Vanderpost's story. There was something curiously human about the face of the mantis. Its heart-shaped pointed chin, high cheekbones, and yellow skin made it look just like a Bushman's. The appearance of a praying mantis in the middle of Manhattan is a very unusual occurrence in and of itself, to say the least. If one considers the timing of its appearance, though, and coinciding with Joe's intense immersion in the mythology of Kalahari Bushmen and his unexplainable, irrational impulse to open the window, the statistical improbability of this event is truly astronomical. And the fact that Bushmen see Mantis as a cosmic trickster seems very appropriate for this situation. Only a hardcore materialist committed to his or her worldview with a quasi-religious fervor could believe that something like this might have happened by pure chance. The events described in the next story happened during one of our month-long seminars at Esalen, at a time when Christina was experiencing her spiritual emergency. Her spontaneous experiences were very intense and rich, and combined elements from various levels of the personal and collective unconscious. One day she had particularly intense and significant visions involving a white swan. Our guest faculty for the following day was Michael Harner, a well-known anthropologist and dear friend. Michael belonged to a group often referred to as visionary anthropologists. In contrast to traditional mainstream anthropologists, they actively participated in the ceremonies of the cultures they studied, whether these involved consciousness-expanding substances such as peyote, magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, or datura, or all-night trance dances and other non-pharmacological technologies of the sacred. Michael's discovery of the way of the shaman's work and their incredible inner world began in 1960, when the American Museum of Natural History invited him to make a year-long expedition to the Peruvian Amazon to study the culture of the Conibo Indians of the Ucayali River region. His guides told him that if he really wished to learn, he had to take the shaman's sacred drink. Following their advice, he ingested ayahuasca, a brew containing a decoction of the jungle liana, Banisteriopsis capi, and the kawa plant, which the Indians called soul vine, or little death. He undertook an astonishing visionary journey through ordinarily invisible dimensions of existence, during which he experienced his own death and obtained extraordinary insights and revelations about the nature of reality. When he later found out that a Conibo elder, a master shaman, was quite familiar with everything he himself had seen, and that his ayahuasca experiences paralleled certain passages from the Book of Revelation, Michael became convinced that there was indeed a hidden world to be explored. He decided to learn everything that he could about shamanism. 3 years later, Michael returned to South America to do fieldwork with the Jivaro, an Ecuadorian headhunting tribe, whom Michael had lived with and studied in 1956 and 1957. Here he experienced another important initiatory experience, which was key to his discovery of the way of the shaman. Akachu, a famous Jivaro shaman, and his son-in-law took him to a sacred waterfall deep in the Amazonian jungle and gave him a drink of maikua, the juice of the Brugmansia species of Datura, a plant with powerful psychoactive properties. As a result of these and other experiences, Michael, an anthropologist with good academic credentials, became an accomplished practitioner and teacher of shamanism. He and his wife, Sandra, also started the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, an institution dedicated to teaching shamanic methods to interested students and to offering shamanic workshops for the public. Michael had written a book entitled The Way of the Shaman, in which he gathered various methods of shamanic work from all over the world and adapted them for use in experiential workshops and in shamanic training for Westerners. During our Esalen month-long workshop, Michael led us on a healing journey using the method of the spirit canoe, as practiced by the Salish Indian tribe in the American Northwest. He began the session by beating his drum and invited participants to move and dance until they identified with a specific animal. It did not take long, and soon people were crouching, crawling on all fours, and jumping around, emulating many climbing, digging, clawing, swimming, and flying movements. The main room in Esalen's big house was filled with various recognizable and unrecognizable voices of animals and birds. When everybody had made the connection with a specific animal, Michael asked the group members to sit down on the floor in a spindle-like formation, creating an imaginary spirit canoe. He then asked if there was a person who needed healing, and Christina volunteered. Michael stepped into the boat, holding his drum, beckoned Christina to join him, and instructed her to lie down. With the scene for the healing voyage all set, Michael asked us to imagine that we were an animal crew undertaking a journey on a canoe into the underworld to retrieve Christina's spirit animal. The specific location that Michael chose for this imaginary expedition was the system of interconnected underground caverns filled with hot water that allegedly stretches under much of California. The entry into it was easy to find, since this system feeds the Esalen hot springs. As the captain of this spirit boat, Michael explained, he would indicate the pace of the paddling by the beat of his drum. During the journey, he would look for spirit animals. When a particular spirit animal appeared three times, this would be the sign that he found the one he was looking for. At that point, he would seize it and would signal to the crew of the boat by the rapid beat of the drum that it was time for a hasty return. We had done the Salish spirit canoe with Michael several times before. The first time we did it, we did not go into it with great expectations. The whole thing sounded like innocent fun, a great idea for children's play, but a somewhat silly activity for mature adults. The very first thing that happened in this initial experience, however, made us change our minds. In the group was a young woman who behaved in a way that had antagonized the entire group. She was very unhappy about it, since the same thing had happened earlier in her life in just about every group in which she had been involved, and she decided to volunteer for the spirit canoe journey to be healed. As the imaginary boat was traveling through the underworld, she had a very violent reaction at the exact moment when Michael signaled that he had identified and seized her spirit animal. She suddenly sat up, and as Michael was giving the signal for return by rapid beats of his drum, she went through several spastic episodes of projectile vomiting. As she was throwing up, she lifted the front part of her skirt, trying to contain what was coming out, and completely filled it with her vomit. This episode, lasting no more than 25 minutes, had a profound effect on her personality. The change in her behavior was so dramatic that before the month-long workshop ended, she became one of the most loved and popular people in the group. This, along with similar episodes later on, made us approach this process with respect. Michael began drumming, and the journey into the underworld began. We all paddled and made sounds of the animals with which we had identified. Christina went into intense convulsions that were shaking her entire body. In and of itself, this was not unusual, since she was in the middle of a Kundalini awakening, during which experiences of powerful energies and tremors, kriyas, are very common. After about 10 minutes, Michael greatly accelerated the rhythm of his drumming, letting us know that he had succeeded in finding Christina's spirit animal. Everybody began paddling quickly, imagining a rapid return to the middle world. Michael stopped drumming, indicating that the journey had ended. He put down the drum, pressed his mouth on Christina's sternum, and blew with all the force he could muster, making a loud sound. He then whispered into her ear, "Your spirit animal is a white swan." Following this, he asked her to perform in front of the group a dance, expressing her swan energy. It is important to mention that Michael had no prior knowledge of Christina's inner process, and that this bird had figured importantly in her experiences the day before. He also had no idea that the swan had been a very important personal symbol for Christina. She was an ardent devotee of Swami Muktananda and a student of Siddha Yoga, where the swan played an important role as a symbol of Brahma. The story continued the next morning when Christina and I walked to our mailbox on Highway 1 to get our mail. Christina received a letter from a person who had attended a workshop we had given several months earlier. Inside was a photograph of Christina's spiritual teacher, Swami Muktananda, which this person thought Christina might like to have. It showed him sitting on a garden swing with a mischievous expression near a large flower pot shaped like a white swan. The index finger of his left hand was pointing at the swan. The tips of his right thumb and index finger were joined, forming the universal sign indicating hitting the bullseye and excitement. Although there was no causal connections between Christina's inner experiences, Michael's choice of the white swan as her power animal, and Muktananda's photograph, they clearly formed a meaningful psychological pattern. This met the criteria for synchronicity, or an a-causal connecting principle as defined by C.G. Jung. Even more remarkable events happened in connection with one of our training modules. It took place in a beautiful retreat center called Pocket Ranch near Healdsburg, California, which is north of San Francisco. The center was located in the mountains in a natural setting abounding with wildlife. Deer, rabbits, rattlesnakes, raccoons, skunks, and a wide range of birds. One of the participants had a very powerful and meaningful session with many shamanic motifs. An important part of it was an encounter with a horned owl. She felt that the owl had become her personal power animal. After the session, she went for a walk into the forest and came back with remnants, bones and feathers of a horned owl. 2 days later, when she was driving home from the training, she noticed something moving in the trench on the side of the road. She stopped and found a large wounded horned owl. The owl allowed her to pick him or her up, drive home, and nurse it back to health. This was an extremely rare occurrence, but in combination with her moving and important experience of receiving a horned owl as a spirit animal, this certainly makes it an extraordinary synchronicity. As I mentioned earlier, Jung had such trust in the authenticity and reliability of synchronicity that he used it as a guiding principle in his life. I have also learned over the years to honor synchronicities in my life, but more cautiously, tempering their compelling effect with discerning intellectual judgment. I have found that it is particularly important not to act under their influence when I am in a holotropic state of consciousness, and I advise the same to my friends, trainees, and patients. I describe how I learned the hard way to deal with synchronicities and archetypal experiences in my book, When the Impossible Happens, in the chapter, The Rainbow Bridge of the Gods, in the realm of the Nordic sagas. The first 5 weeks of my relationship with Florida anthropologist Joan Halifax, which culminated in our wedding in Iceland, was replete with extraordinary and glorious synchronicities, which seemed to indicate that our union would be a marriage made in heaven. The wedding ceremony took place during the first International Transpersonal Conference, with 74 enthusiastic participants sharing our excitement. Our joiner was renowned philosopher and religious scholar Houston Smith, author of The World's Religions. Joseph Campbell and Icelandic mythologist Einar Pálsson recreated an ancient Viking ritual for us that had not been performed in Iceland since the arrival of Christians on the island. The central archetypal symbol for this wedding ritual was the rainbow, which the Vikings saw as the union of Father Sky and Mother Earth. It was June beyond the Arctic Circle, the time of the amazing white nights. During the dinner banquet preceding the wedding ritual, a glorious double rainbow appeared and disappeared 3 times. We also found out that Bifrost, the name of the place where the wedding took place, meant the Rainbow Bridge of the Gods. To our disappointment, the glorious marriage that this, to use Arthur Koestler's expression, meteor shower of synchronicities seemed to predict, did not materialize. After 3 years of a difficult and challenging marriage, we came to the conclusion that our personalities were too different and decided to dissolve our union. On the opposite side of the spectrum was a remarkable synchronicity that brought very positive results, which was also connected with an international transpersonal conference. I founded the International Transpersonal Association, ITA, as an organization designed to bridge the gap between modern science and the spiritual traditions of the world, and between Western pragmatism and ancient wisdom. Since the ultimate goal of the ITA was to create a global network of mutual understanding and cooperation, during our international conferences, we very much missed participants from the countries beyond the Iron Curtain, who at that time were not allowed to travel abroad and did not have the financial means to join us. When the situation in the Soviet Union changed, and Mikhail Gorbachev declared the era of glasnost and perestroika, it suddenly seemed plausible that the next ITA meeting could be held in Russia. When Christina and I were invited to Moscow as official guests of the Soviet Ministry of Health in order to conduct holotropic breathwork workshops, we used our visit to explore the possibility of holding such a conference in Russia. We tried very hard, but without success. The situation seemed too unstable and volatile to take the chance. Our efforts to bring our conference to Russia felt like walking through molasses. In November 1989, I was traveling when I received a telephone call from Christina, who asked me if I knew what was happening in my native country. Our training was very intense and featured 3 sessions a day. We were deeply immersed in the process, and none of us had the time or interest to watch television or follow the news. Christina informed me that the Prague Velvet Revolution was underway, and that the Czechoslovakian communist regime would very likely fall. This meant that we might be able to hold the next ITA conference in Prague, the city where I was born. A few weeks later, Czechoslovakia was a free country, and the ITA board decided to hold its next meeting in Czechoslovakia. Since I was born in Prague, it seemed only logical to send me to Czechoslovakia as an envoy to find the site and prepare the ground for this conference. However, the years I had spent in my native country turned out to be much less of an advantage than the board expected. I had left Czechoslovakia at the time of a major liberalization movement aimed at creating socialism with a human face. In 1968, when the Prague Spring was brutally suppressed by the invasion of Czechoslovakia by Soviet tanks, I was in the United States on a scholarship at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. After the invasion, I was ordered by Czech authorities to return immediately, but decided to disobey and stay in the United States. As a result, I was not able to visit my native country for more than 20 years. During this time, I could not maintain open contact with my friends and colleagues in Czechoslovakia. It would have been politically dangerous for them to exchange letters or phone calls with an illegal immigrant. Due to my long absence, I had lost all my connections except for my close relatives, was not familiar with the new situation, and did not have any idea where to begin. My mother met me at the Prague airport, and we took a taxi to her apartment. After we had spent some time together, she left the apartment to visit a neighbor and run a few errands. Alone in the apartment, I sat down in an armchair, had a cup of tea, and reflected on my mission. I contemplated the situation for about 10 minutes, but was not getting very far. Suddenly, my train of thought was interrupted by a loud ringing of the doorbell. I answered the door and recognized Tomáš Dostál, a younger psychiatrist colleague of mine who, in the old days, used to be my close friend. Before my departure for the United States, we had shared some explorations of holotropic states of consciousness by sitting for each other in our LSD sessions. Tomáš had heard from an acquaintance of his about my visit to Prague and came to welcome me. I then learned, to my astonishment, that just as Tomáš was leaving his apartment, his home telephone rang. It was Ivan Havel, a prominent researcher in artificial intelligence and the brother of the Czech president Václav Havel. He was also the leader of a group of progressive scientists who had held secret underground meetings during the communist era, exploring various new avenues in Western science. They were particularly interested in the new paradigm thinking, consciousness research, and transpersonal psychology. Ivan Havel and Tomáš had been classmates in the gymnasium, the Czech equivalent of high school, and had remained close friends ever since. Tomáš had been a frequent guest in the Havel household and also knew Ivan's brother Václav. Ivan Havel's group had heard about my work through the lecture of Vasily Nalimov, whom they had invited to Prague as guest lecturer. Vasily was a brilliant Russian scientist, mathematician, and philosopher. As a former Soviet dissident, he had spent 18 years in a Siberian labor camp. By strange coincidence, the title of his most famous book was Realms of the Unconscious, which is very close to the title of my first book, Realms of the Human Unconscious. Vasily had included an extensive report about my psychedelic research in his book and discussed my work at length in his lecture for the Prague group. As a result of Vasily's talk, the Prague group became interested in having me as a guest lecturer. Ivan Havel knew that Tomáš and I were old friends and called him to inquire whether he had my address or telephone number and would be able to mediate contact between the Prague group and myself. He was astonished when Tomáš told him that I happened to be visiting Prague and that he was about to walk out of his apartment to pay me a visit. This very unlikely concatenation of synchronistic events made us feel that we were surfing a powerful wave rather than paddling against the rapids, the way it had felt when we were in Moscow. This spectacular set of coincidences greatly facilitated my role as envoy for the ITA conference. It took me only 10 minutes, in unfamiliar circumstances, to find the ideal contact and support for our future meeting. A group of highly competent academics connected to the university system, who are vitally interested in bringing to Prague a stellar cast of foreign scientists whom they had admired for years. By the same token, I had also found access to the president of the country, who happened to be an enlightened and deeply spiritually oriented person, open to the transpersonal perspective. In view of these circumstances, we felt that we were hired to do the conference rather than striving to organize it. The conference was held in 1993 in Prague's Smetana Concert Hall and the municipal house under the aegis of President Václav Havel. President Havel was an ideal guest of honor for an ITA conference. He was not a run-of-the-mill politician, but somebody who was much more appropriately referred to as a statesman, the head of state with a broad, spiritually based, global vision. A well-known playwright, he did not become president as a result of years of struggle for political power. He very reluctantly accepted the nomination, responding to an urgent plea of the Czech people, who loved him as a courageous dissident of the communist regime, and who had spent many years in communist prison. One of the first things he did after his inauguration was to acknowledge His Holiness the Dalai Lama as the head of Tibet and invite him for a 3-day state visit. Wherever he went, he impressed his audiences with his eloquent call for spiritually based democracy and global solidarity. The Prague ITA conference, which was the first opportunity for Eastern and Western representatives of the transpersonal movement to meet and exchange information, was a great success. The highlight of the program was the performance of Babatunde Olatunji, a Yoruba singer, with 10 African drummers and dancers. After receiving an enthusiastic standing ovation for their stunning act, the performers decided not to recede behind the curtain, but continued dancing through the center of the hall and out through the front entrance of the building into the streets of Prague. Followed by a significant part of the audience, they sang, drummed, and danced down Seletna Ulice, a small street in the historical part of Prague, to Old Town Square. On the way, they were joined by a large number of Prague citizens from the neighboring houses, attracted by the bacchanalian spectacle. The jubilant crowd filled the square and continued to dance to the sound of African drums and songs until the wee hours of the morning. After 40 years of communist oppression, when even the twist was considered an unacceptable indulgence, this event was an apt symbol of freshly regained freedom. The incidence of synchronicities seems to increase around events involving transpersonal psychology. They occur with great frequency to participants in our workshops and training. The most remarkable synchronicity I have ever experienced occurred during my first visit to China. Our small group included several holotropic breathwork facilitators, my brother with his partner Mary, camerawoman Sally Lee, myself, and Bill Melton and Mei Shi, who inspired and supported the expedition. The purpose of this trip was to introduce transpersonal psychology and holotropic breathwork to China. Before telling this story, I have to mention an important piece of information. In 1978, my wife Christina and myself founded the International Transpersonal Association, ITA. We had spent some time trying to choose the best logo for this organization, and finally decided to use a stylized design of the chambered nautilus shell, a perfect example of sacred geometry. We used this logo over several decades on the brochures of all our conferences. There have been 20 of them to this day, on advertising and on our stationery. Our first holotropic breathwork workshop took place in Jinan, the birthplace of the Chinese spiritual teacher and philosopher Confucius. During the dinner break, one of the participants, Mrs. Meng, meaning dream, came to me holding a small, beautiful blue velvet bag. She told me that her great-grandmother had appeared in her dream and told her that they had kept a very special stone in her family for several generations, and that she should take it to Dr. Groff. She then handed the object to me. It was a fossil nautilus shell, a marine mollusk, but it had been found and collected at the top of Mount Everest. I had never heard about fossil marine forms of life being found on the top of Mount Everest. I decided to study the geological history of the Himalayas and found out that the age of this famous mountain range was estimated to be about 50 million years. When large tectonic plates collided, starting a series of volcanic explosions and lifted up the bottom of the ocean. The top of Mount Everest therefore contains layers of various provenance, including those that originated at the bottom of the ocean. The fossil nautilus thus had to have been at the bottom of the sea before the Himalayas had been created, and therefore be at least 50 million years old. The purpose of our expedition was to bring transpersonal psychology to China. The fact that Mrs. Meng's great-grandmother appeared in her dream and asked her to bring me the symbol of the International Transpersonal Association, a nautilus shell, fossilized and lifted from the bottom of the ocean to the top of the highest mountain of the world, tens of millions of years ago, was truly a miraculous synchronicity. I mentioned it briefly in my presentation at the Beijing University, and in the Chinese press it received more attention than anything else in my talk. However, this was not the only remarkable synchronicity that we encountered during this trip. It seemed that we had entered a magic world where linear causality no longer applied. I will mention just two more of these memorable coincidences. We found out that the organizers of the Chinese trip scheduled an appearance at Beijing University for my close and dear friend Jack Kornfield, a Vipassana Buddhist teacher, on the same evening that the organizers of our trip quite independently tried to schedule me. When this was discovered, the organizers decided to create a joint evening for us called Groff in Discussion with Kornfield. Jack and I had led and co-led many events over the last 40 years, but had never met anywhere unless we had jointly planned it. The second of these synchronicities involved one of our translators and a breathwork facilitator, who were scheduled to join us on a train from Jinan to Beijing. Although they purchased their tickets independently, one from northern China and the other from the south, they ended up sitting not only in the same wagon and compartment as our group, but in seats adjacent to each other. As I was witnessing how the series of synchronicities brought an element of magic into our group, I had to think about the quote from the Czech-French writer, Milan Kundera, the author of The Unbearable Lightness of Being. It is wrong to chide the novel for being fascinated by mysterious coincidences, but it is right to chide man for being blind to such coincidences in his daily life, for he thereby deprives his life of a dimension of beauty. The knowledge of the phenomenon of synchronicity is essential not only for psychonauts and archetypal astrologers, but also for scientists who still subscribe to the materialistic worldview. It is one of the most obvious and critical challenges to monistic materialistic philosophy. A statement that Jung made in 1955 in a letter to R.F.C. Hull made it clear that he was well aware of this fact. The latest comment about synchronicity is that it cannot be accepted because it shakes the security of our scientific foundations, as if this were not exactly the goal I am aiming at. On the same day he wrote to Michael Fordham about the impact of synchronicity upon the fanatical one-sidedness of scientific philosophy. Marie-Louise von Franz, aware of the paradigm-breaking potential of synchronicity, said in an interview late in her life, "The work which is now to be done is to work out the concept of synchronicity. I don't know the people who will continue it. They must exist, but I don't know where they are." Fortunately, the literature on synchronicity and its pivotal importance for a number of disciplines has since grown exponentially, and this concept has become an integral part of the emerging new paradigm in science.